Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
For the second time this week, U.S. soldiers fired on anti-American protesters in the city of Fallujah. The mayor there said that two people were killed and 14 wounded. The dead and injured were protesting a shooting less than 48 hours earlier that killed 13, according to hospital officials. American officers are saying that enemy Iraqi forces are using civilians as cover, provoking the shootings. But the mayor of Fallujah says his people view Americans as occupiers, and he asked for an investigation and compensation. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Elizabeth Newfer. She's a reporter for the Boston Globe. Elizabeth, I know you were in Fallujah. Tell us more about what U.S. officials are saying provoked these shootings.
Well, U.S. officials paint a very different picture than the local residents of Fallujah. As the U.S. military sees it, a peaceful protest was infiltrated by men toting Kalashnikovs and deliberately aiming at American troops, forcing them, in fact, to take fire in self-defense. That they sort of painted this as a kind of infiltration, some bad guys getting in with the crowd and making trouble. But local residents insist that there was absolutely nobody who was armed.
Well, you write also that in Fallujah, actions by the U.S. troops have been really badly misread. Tell us what one youth told you about having the U.S. troops posted on the elementary school that was the site of the original protest.
Yes. One youth, in fact, I heard this from several people, told me that they were very concerned because having soldiers up on the roof of the school, which is, a two-story building, meant that they could look down into people's yards. Now, in sort of this is a sort of city kind of out in the country about 30 miles west of Baghdad. And yards are sort of enclosures, high-walled enclosures around a house in which women in a tribal and conservative society can be free to unveil because no one can see them except for their family. But, of course, if you have a man up on a roof, he can look down into the yard and hence see the woman. And there was strong sentiment that the honor of local women was being violated.
Right. So in addition to protesting the U.S. forces who were using the school, we understand, as a headquarters, there seemed to be a lot of other emotions running high there. What is the U.S. military doing now?
Well, they had pulled out of the school, and I'm sure that they're going to be, you know, making every effort they can to calm the situation down. They were quick to point out that during their time in Fallujah, they'd only been there for the last 4 or 5 days, but they'd had a reasonably positive response from about 90% of the population that, you know, this was sort of an isolated incident. So I'm sure they will be holding talks with the mayor and holding talks with the local priests and trying to restore calm once again.
And, of course, the mayor and other Iraqis that you spoke with are saying there were no guns, there was no firing from the crowd. But some military analysts we've spoken to have said that protests might have to be outlawed in Fallujah as U.S. forces are trying to convince Iraqis that the forces are liberators and not occupiers. How do you think that will go over?
Well, I mean, it is kind of ironic that we claim to be bringing democracy to Iraq and then we might try to actually outlaw demonstrations. At the same time, one has to realize that this is a society in state of transition, and there are a lot of guns on the street that aren't registered, that were stolen during the massive looting that went on. There's a lot of lawlessness. There still isn't a police presence. Things aren't organized. So, you know, as ironic as it might be, banning demonstrations perhaps or somehow trying to organize them somehow might not be such a bad move, as ironic as it might seem.
Mm. Well, Elizabeth, thank you.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth Newfer, a reporter for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from Baghdad.
There's been a referendum in the Persian Gulf state of Qatar in which Qataris overwhelmingly voted 96.6% for a new constitution to establish a parliamentary democracy. Now, in the Middle East, any vote of nearly 100% can raise warning flags. Saddam Hussein used to win re-election by margins like that. But the vote in Qatar appears to be the real thing, real change, where Qatar's emir, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, has held absolute power since Qatar's independence from Britain in 1971. Well, to learn more about this apparently transformative moment in Qatar, we're joined now by Khalid Al-Khatir. He is a democracy campaigner in Qatar, and he joins us from the capital, Doha. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Al-Khatir.
You're welcome.
Mr. Al-Khatir, Will this constitution give Qataris real democracy?
I don't think so.
Tell us why.
Well, because it is really what's called minimalist democracy.
Uh-huh.
Most Qataris who voted are actually don't realize what they have voted on. It has been shoved through very strong media, and it has been distorted by some officials that it gives them greater rights than what it really would. So I know a lot of close friends that voted yes, but when I explained to them the fault with this constitution, they regretted that vote.
So what you're saying is that the emir will retain control?
Yes. There is no judiciary or constitutional judiciary in this government. There's nothing like the Supreme Court in the United States, where conflict between the executive branch and the legislative branch could be resolved. And this is a major fault in this constitution. People don't realize that the first and only resolve the emir has to come up with in case of conflict is to dissolve the advisory council.
There are some 650,000 people living in Qatar, but as I understand it, only about 150,000 are citizens. The others are all guest workers. How does that affect the reality of democracy in Qatar?
Well, this demography is very, very, or the structure of demography here in Qatar is very dangerous. Only the population or the indigenous population only make one-fifth of the total population. Most of the population are Asians, laborers or maid workers or house workers. They are underpaid. They are not treated as a human.
And, of course, those people, those guest workers, will not be able to vote.
No, they are not eligible to vote. Only a Qatari-born citizen is eligible.
You say democracy in Qatar is still something of, a false front. What does that say, then, about the possibility of real democracy taking root in the rest of the Middle East, if it can't really happen, you say, even in Qatar?
I think the possibility depends entirely on what the Bush administration does in Iraq. If it succeeds in Iraq, it will be there will be a chance for democratization spreading all over the Arab world. If it doesn't, then the hope is very little. Because, you see, democratization can be done top-down and bottom-up. Of course, there is no hope from top-down, only bottom-up, which is civil society and education. You see, let's go back a little. Like Saddam Hussein had a very excellent constitution, by the way. It was never implemented. Most Arab countries have good constitution, but it's all ink on paper. Nothing really. The will is not there, you see. And if the will is there, the first thing that they will allow the people is accountability for public funds, which is missing, of course. They don't want anybody to talk about public funds. Qatar is probably the richest country in the world. And no, they don't want anybody to question that, where those resources go.
We want to thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Al-Qatar.
You're welcome.
Khaled Al-Qatar is a democracy campaigner in Qatar, and he joined us from the capital, Doha.
Human rights activists, leftist intellectuals, and world leaders are condemning yesterday's re-election of Cuba to the UN Commission on Human Rights just weeks after Fidel Castro was roundly criticized for his roundup of dissidents, long-term jail sentences for political opposition leaders, and the execution of three men attempting to hijack a ferry boat to Florida. Today, Florida Congressman Mark Foley is introducing a resolution to the House calling for Cuba's removal from the Human Rights Panel. And Congressman Foley joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Tell us a little bit about your resolution. Was this immediate?
Yes, my resolution is now going to the floor. It's being delivered today to the clerk for introduction in the House. We're basically asking the U.N. to rescind their recent vote and to remove and expel Cuba from the Human Rights Panel. It's the fair thing to do. It's just, and it obviously recognizes Cuba's lack of respect for human life and human dignity.
What are your thoughts about the commission itself? It had asked Cuba to accept a human rights monitor, which Cuba rejected, so now Cuba serves on a panel it refused to abide by.
Well, that shows the lawlessness by which this panel's operating. It smacks of a cronyism in the panel. It's as if we were going to suggest Dr. Kevorkian to be Surgeon General of the United States. It's troubling to me, and it's terrible at a time when we're trying to bring the world together for world peace, liberation, and freedom for citizens worldwide.
Well, White House spokesman Ari Fleischer has said it is like putting Al Capone in charge of bank security. It's hard to find anyone today who's in favor of this. The Vatican has been speaking out to Castro's Cuba about the crackdown on dissidents. Author Gabriel Garcia Marquez, one of Castro's closest friends, has come out against him. And yet, there might be some who say if you keep them in the world community and keep them on the commission, then perhaps they could be influenced by other countries.
I don't buy it. I don't think Fidel Castro cares about anyone else, and I think by keeping him on the panel simply gives him tacit approval for the acts of violence against his own citizens. So this should not be a reward-based system. If we're going to keep a watch on him, we ought to give him the rules of engagement, tell him if he complies within the next year, then he may be allowed to be back on the panel, but he should have a timeout as we do for little kids. This guy is sick. He's hurtful. He should not be part of any tribunal.
What are your constituents in West Palm Beach telling you?
Well, the constituents in West Palm Beach, of course, have been frustrated with the United Nations. They're particularly outraged that Libya and Cuba would be added to a panel or allowed to remain on a panel. That's very nature is to ensure human rights. So they're loudly voicing their opinion. They're suggesting tax dollars could be spent on veterans' health care rather than the United Nations. They're also tired of spending money on an organization that does not seem to recognize the world law or world order.
Well, you, we've been hearing, you're also someone who's critical of the UN. With this action, what do you think is that organization's future?
Well, I would say the future is rather dim. They've done some good things in their past, and you hate to condemn an entirety of an organization, but it seems in recent months and years we have gotten less cooperation and have had more requests for financial aid from the United States. I don't think those two go hand in hand. I think it's time to decouple our alliance with them and work on another proposal.
Congressman Foley, have you heard one of your colleagues supporting Cuba being on the Human Rights Commission?
No, I haven't.
Even Congressman William Delahunt, a big Cuba supporter, has recently been critical.
Yeah, Bill's very, very gracious, and he's also very informed on the nature of these disputes. So if he's not even supporting them, they're going to be hard-pressed to find anyone.
Representative Mark Foley, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Florida Representative Mark Foley spoke to us from his office in Washington, D.C.
Just ahead, is an arrest imminent in connection with the deadly anthrax attacks of 2001? We speak with the author of the new book, The Killer Strain, Anthrax and a Government Exposed.
And later, spam, spam, spam. Can anyone stop it? The FTC aims to try with the opening of a 3-day forum on spam.
In Washington, there's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Egypt has called for the swift implementation of a U.S.-backed roadmap for Israel-Palestine peace. For more on that story, go to our website, WBUR.org, and click on news. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Somerville Open Studios this weekend, featuring more than 200 artists in this citywide event. Shuttle bus service is available. Information and map at SomervilleOpenStudios.org. Coco Budakian and Sons in Winchester, hosting Art on the Floor, an information session about Oriental rugs with Bill Delaney, tonight from 7 to 9. Tickets at WBUR.org. And Upstairs on the Square, celebrating Mother's Day with a spring brunch menu or a classic Sunday dinner from noon to 6 p.m. in their soiree room, opening especially for Mother's Day. It's 57 degrees, looking for a high around 62 today under mostly sunny skies. Clouds coming in tonight and tomorrow with daytime highs tomorrow around 68.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Bob Stevens was a 63-year-old photo editor in Florida. Thomas Morris and Joseph Kersine were postal workers in Washington, D.C. Kathy Nguyen lived alone in the Bronx. And Adelie Lundgren, a 94-year-old widow, died in the hospital in Connecticut. These were the five deaths in the anthrax attacks of 2001. Others were infected but lived to tell the tale. And what a tale it is. A year and a half later, the case is unsolved, the chief suspect not charged, and America, well, is America any better prepared for the next one? Marilyn Thompson is the author of a new book, The Killer Strain, Anthrax and a Government Exposed. And we now welcome Marilyn Thompson to Here and Now.
Thank you, Bill.
Now, the kind of anthrax that killed these five people and made so many others sick is a very specific kind. It's one of the 89 strains of anthrax, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
This strain of anthrax was quickly identified after the first case in Florida as something known as the Ames strain, which was taken from a dead cow in a field in Texas and used to cultivate the strain that would be tested in the labs.
And this is the strain that was primarily used at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases, Fort Detrick, right?
Yes, and at other U.S. Army medical research facilities. It was a very narrow universe. People who had worked with weaponized or highly refined anthrax in this country came down to a very limited number of scientists. There was, of course, the illicit chain of access, which is another story.
Yes. Until the late 1990s, anthrax was freely traded from laboratory to laboratory, even around the world, right?
Not only that, but anthrax was dealt out by germ culture collections all over this country and other countries. And we, in fact, supplied a number of strains of anthrax to the bioweapons developers in Iraq.
So before the late 1990s, when that was all restricted by the government, anthrax could have wound up in the hands of foreign agents, right? Why were authorities so certain so early on after the attacks that this was very likely an attack engineered by someone within the United States?
Well, it could have ended up, but the most likely culprits, they believe, were domestic. Iraq, for example, while it had many strains of anthrax, was not known to have possessed the Ames strain.
Who is Dr. Stephen J. Hatfield?
Dr. Hatfield is a medical doctor who spent a good deal of time in Rhodesia and South Africa, has had a very flamboyant career, and ended up in the labs of Fort Detrick at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute, analyzing pathogens and doing a number of federally funded research projects on pathogens. And he's now the chief person of interest in this case, still under 24-hour watch by the FBI.
Chief person of interest.
Yes, odd term. Term that has come to represent how frustrating this whole case has been for the FBI. They've not called him a suspect.
How likely is it, do you think, that there will be an arrest in this case soon?
Well, I had a meeting just last week with a very senior FBI official and was assured that they are feeling very hopeful about this case. Despite all evidence to the contrary, they believe that they are now closing in on a person and will soon have evidence to take before a grand jury and get an indictment. My personal feeling is that, yes, they are narrowing in on someone. And I think that we should watch it very closely over the next 3 to 4 months.
You certainly seem to argue in The Killer Strain, though, that authorities should have been better prepared.
I think they should have. I mean, this situation in the Brentwood Postal Facility, for example, where two postal workers died, to my mind, was completely unnecessary.
The Brentwood Postal Facility, largely black workers, when anthrax infiltrated Senator Daschle's office, the federal office building was immediately closed. People were being given vaccinations and hurried out of the building. And that didn't happen at Brentwood, did it? And there were charges of racism. What do you think of those charges?
Well, it's very interesting, Bill, because just recently, in fact, within the past several weeks, the first General Accounting Office report on the Postal Service's behavior in this whole episode has come out, and it's quite damning. It deals with the facility in Wallingford, Connecticut, which was the facility that most likely processed an anthrax tainted letter that ended up in the home of this pathetic 95-year-old lady who died from anthrax, from cross-contaminated mail, most likely. What this report said quite clearly was that the Postal Service knew that this facility was contaminated, and for whatever reason, it simply chose not to convey that information to the workforce. And so people who could have been spared were left subjected to anthrax.
Marilyn Thompson, after your study of all this, you seem to be saying it's an open question whether we're better protected than we were a year and a half ago from a bioterrorism attack with something like anthrax.
Well, I mean, obviously we've spent money trying to protect ourselves against anthrax, and yet look at the strides we've made or haven't made. We still do not have an anthrax vaccine that's readily available and that is considered safe and effective. The vaccine that is available for the military has been surrounded by controversy, and we have knowledge that antibiotic treatment within 48 hours could save lives. There's a question about how widely that knowledge has been disseminated. And now we have a new level of bureaucracy. We have the Office of Homeland Security, which we have to entrust with helping us in the next situation like this. And let's just hope that it works.
Let's just hope that it works. Marilyn Thompson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marilyn Thompson is author of The Killer Strain, Anthrax and a Government Exposed.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we preview a new Frontline special on the lives of wrongly convicted prisoners after they've been cleared by DNA evidence.
And from The Iceman Cometh to Rhinoceros, theater critic Bill Marks reviews movie versions of classic plays, reborn on DVD. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by ColorTech, photographic and digital processing services for the imaging consumer. Locations include Campus Camera and Kenmore Square, 251 Newbury Street, and 727 Atlantic Avenue. Also, Progressive Asset Management in Wellesley, a division of FWG, a full-service investment firm helping individual clients and businesses align their investments with their values. And the Fort Point Arts Community, announcing their first annual Spring Art Walk with more than 50 artists and craftspeople this Friday and Saturday. Details at fortpointarts.org. You can learn more about our next Citizens of the World tour exploring the culture and landscape of Ireland at a free reception Thursday, May 8th. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287. Coming up on Fresh Air at 1 o'clock, Terry Gross will be talking with journalist Philip Hiltz about his new book, Protecting America's Health.
I'm Robin Young. Think of all the things your mom has done for you. Is the list getting long? Then think about saying thank you this Mother's Day with an exclusive Mother's Day brunch here at the WBUR studios with me and my mom. We'll have a delicious meal, talk amongst ourselves, tour the studios. In all, make the moms among us feel special. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 617-358-2010. That's 617-358-2010. We'll see you there.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, one man's spam is another's meat and potatoes. We hear from a spammer who defends his work, and about a three-day Washington forum designed to do something about the onslaught of unsolicited commercial email.
No one wants to be standing next to a spammer. Spam is about as popular as Ebola.
And listen up, Balmar. Our resident chef Kathy Gunst is on hand to cook up some soft shell crabs.
These stories coming up here and now.
Thank you. I'm Marianne Nichols. President Bush is set to formally announce the end of major combat in Iraq. This according to White House officials. Bush will speak from the deck of an aircraft carrier tomorrow night. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says the president will not be declaring victory because some of the major objectives of the conflict, like finding banned weapons and restoring stability, have not yet been achieved. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the U.S. is trying to use diplomacy to urge countries neighboring Iraq to turn over Iraqi fugitives. Speaking with American soldiers today in Baghdad, Rumsfeld says captured officials from the former Iraqi regime may end up returning to face punishment from the new government.
As an Iraqi government evolves and gets on its feet, it may very well be that they will want to have some of those folks brought back so that they can have a discussion with them.
Rumsfeld is the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit the Iraqi capital since the war began. U.S. Ambassador to Israel Dan Kurtzer is delivering the U.S.'s long-awaited roadmap for peace to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and new Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. The presentation of the plan, which envisions a Palestinian state within 3 years, comes just hours after a suicide bomber linked to the political party of Abbas killed three Israelis in Tel Aviv. Abbas has condemned the bombing. The Energy Department is accepting competitive bids to run the Los Alamos National Laboratory after a series of high-profile management breakdowns. The announcement from Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham would force the University of California, which has run the lab for nearly 60 years, to compete with other universities and private companies for the lab contract. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan is striking an optimistic note on the U.S. economy. In his speech before a House Finance Committee, Greenspan says the economy is now poised for growth in the aftermath of war in Iraq.
A modestly encouraging sign is provided by the backlog of orders for non-defense capital goods, excluding aircraft, which has been moving up in recent months. Households, too, are likely to welcome lower energy bills and a continuation of favorable conditions in mortgage and credit markets.
Greenspan also continued to voice his opposition to President Bush's tax cut plan, saying further cuts would have to be offset by cuts in government spending or tax increases to prevent the deficit from rising. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Crescent Ridge Dairy, the dairy that delivers, offering home delivery of farm fresh milk in glass bottles, now available at Bread and Circus Whole Foods Market and on the web at crescentridge.com. Sudbury Granite and Marble, direct importer and fabricator of granite and marble surfaces for homes in Boston and the Cape and Islands, in Sudbury, Mendon, and West Hartford, Connecticut. And Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, now accepting reservations for graduation celebrations at 617-720-5511 or online at lalaroqh.com. In the forecast today, mostly sunny and cooler, highs around 62. Cloudy tomorrow with highs near 70. It's 56 degrees and sunny and breezy in Boston. In sports, the Red Sox will be playing Kansas City again at Fenway tonight. They beat the Royals last night. And the Pacers and the Celtics will be back tomorrow night at the Fleet Center. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Getting a lot more spam lately? Industry watchers say the amount of unsolicited commercial email people are receiving has exploded in the past year. Spam now accounts for nearly half of all email messages.
And the Federal Trade Commission says about two-thirds of all spam is false or deceptive. So we did a little investigating at the desk of one WBUR staffer, Here and Now.
Let's see, get some of the good ones. We have benign ones like Caribbean Adventure Vacation Packages, and then, of course, Local Match Service for Young Girls. I thought you might need this. Let us show you the light at the end of debt. Surgeon General's warning, get a date tonight. I want to cheat on my husband. Don't spend too much for printer cartridges. Christian Singles, click here.
This is your Hotmail account.
This is my Hotmail account. This is not the junk mail box. The junk mail box is probably going to be all porn. Let's see. Sex in a pool, hot sex pics.
So, we are a society, for the most part, sick of spam. In fact, often seething about spam. The government's, well, getting the message, so to speak. The Federal Trade Commission today opens a 3-day forum on spam in Washington. Eileen Harrington is an FTC spokesperson.
just here at the FTC, we're receiving 130,000 pieces of spam forwarded to us from consumers who don't want it every single day. We know that it slows down delivery of valuable information to consumers and subscribers, but the search for solutions has been a more difficult problem.
The FTC will eventually make recommendations for spurning spam. There is no federal law on spam, but Congress is considering some bills. And just yesterday, the state of Virginia made certain high-volume, fraudulent spamming a criminal offense, which is a first in the U.S. Now, with so much heat being generated around the issue of spam, it would seem people who spam would be breaking out in a bit of a sweat. Well, if they are, Jeff Perot ought to know. He's sales manager for a company, OptinRealBig.com, which fires off more than 10 million commercial messages a day. Most of us would call those commercial messages spam. Jeff Perot now joins us from Westminster, Colorado, where OptinRealBig is based. And welcome, Jeff. Thanks for talking to us.
How are you doing?
Jeff, you present products for sale to people who simply turn on their computers to check for their email. How do you feel about the way you make your living?
I feel very good. It's a legitimate business. We spend a lot of time, money, work hours on trying to keep everything as legit as possible to follow the little guidelines that are out there that we can.
Some of your messages are for the biggest moneymaker of all on the Internet, pornography, yes?
Very, very, very little part of our business.
How good a business is this? How much money is there in it? I have read that even a less than 1% response from sending out these commercial messages will enable you to make money, even millions. True?
I wouldn't say millions. I wish it was that much for sure. We charge per amount of mail that they want to send out, and they pay us for it. So I'm always making my money as far as, I have a price just like, you buy an ad in a newspaper. You have to pay for that, space up front, and you pay the newspaper or the magazine, whatever it may be, and, that's how they make their money.
How do you feel about sending what you call commercial messages, what most people call spam, to people who never asked to be solicited in the first place?
Well, I feel fine because all the names and the data that I have, I can prove the time, the date, where the individual has opted in. Unlike spam companies where they can't prove it, if I get one complaint from any of my vendors and they say I have a complaint from so-and-so, probably take me about 5 to 10 minutes to pull it up in our database on where that person has opted in on one of our lists.
Do you consider yourself finally a spammer?
No.
No. Jeff Perot, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeff Perot is sales manager for the company OptinRealBig.com, an online marketer in Westminster, Colorado.
So, is spam a legitimate marketing tool protected under the First Amendment guarantee of free speech? Or is it a pollutant that threatens to destroy a new technology? There are reports that people are turning from email back to regular mail and the telephone just to avoid spam. Well, we turn now to Jonathan Turley, professor at the George Washington University Law School. And what say you, necessary evil or just plain evil?
I think it's just plain evil at this point. It started out as a mere nuisance, but it's now become something more than that. What we're facing is a threat to one of the greatest technological developments of our generation, something that society needs to remain productive.
You write in an op-ed piece that, in fact, in Japan, people are already giving up their cell phones because most of the text messages are spam. And we're reading that American businesses lose about $9 billion a year just in screening and reading spam. And it's said that there will be 319 billion unsolicited pieces of spam this year, double last year. Why the increase?
Well, I believe that spammers are breaking through technological barriers. It is easy to be a spammer. And so this is what is called in economics a negative externality, somebody who is forcing upon society significant cost in order to get rather limited benefits. This is a form of virtual pollution. We have to do something as a society because the Internet and email is a form of commons. It's like air, It's like commons area of land, where if you don't have some degree of regulation, it can be destroyed.
As you write, if one person grazes on that common, it's okay, but then if a million do, the common's gone. Well, the EU has outlawed certain forms of spam. As we said, Virginia just passed some of the toughest legislation against certain forms of spam. But who's lobbying against it?
Obviously, spam operators are opposed. That type of lobbying occurs in a surreptitious manner. No one wants to be standing next to a spammer. Spam is about as popular as Ebola, so politicians are not likely to associate themselves. Retailers are concerned, and even anti-spam companies would hardly be enthusiastic about eliminating the problem upon which their fortunes are made.
Well, in fact, do we hear that some of the major Internet companies, such as AOL, that appear to support the legislation against spam are also lobbying against that legislation?
Yes. I mean, there's a great deal of surreptitious lobbying going on. Anti-spam legislation has been in this Congress for the last 5 years. Each one has died. Members have come forward, cloaked themselves in the anti-spam cause while working with companies to kill the very legislation they're working on. Hmm.
Professor, one last question. What can people do? I mean, it may be an urban legend, but we've heard that online there's a high-tech site that actually published the home address of a spammer, and people retaliated by sending him all their real junk mail to his mailbox.
I think their time, it would be much better spent really pursuing their members of Congress and demand to know what they're going to do this Congress, because there's a lot of spin going on from members who are telling their constituents they're against spam, but they're doing a lot of backroom work with companies that want this legislation to die.
Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Jonathan Turley from the George Washington University Law School. Still to come, resident chef Kathy Gunst serves up soft-shell crabs.
You're listening to Here and Now. When she was just 20 years old, jazz singer Renee Marie put her career on hold to start a family. Now, two decades later, she's back, winning over critics and audiences. Independent producer David Shulman spoke to Renee Marie.
I don't like giving the band too much direction. Otherwise, I don't feel like I'm showing respect for their musicianship. So I just have these pieces in my head. I know part of the song, well, I want it to sound this way. And then at some point we do this. And then at some point we do that. That's how we did Blackbird for the first time. And the feel of the brushes in a march. Like that. We rehearsed maybe 8 bars just so they could get the feel. I didn't even know how I was going to sing it, except I wanted to keep the melody of the first part.
Blackbird!
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. My son was about 3 months old. He was old enough to sit up just a bit without falling forward, and I had to put a pillow in front of him, and I put him in the corner of the sofa, and I started singing songs to him to stop him from fretting so much, because he needed a lot of attention as a baby. And I had a ball doing it, and I realized, man, I still have this comic touch.
I like you better than that first cup of coffee. I like you better than licking the spoon. I like you better than finding a shady spot in the middle of June.
I'm a good mimic, and I could imitate certain qualities of Cleo Lane's voice and certain qualities of Sarah Vaughan's and qualities of Ella's. With Ella, she has a light sound, like when she does Blue Skies. Blue sky shining on me, nothing but blue skies do I see. But with Sarah Vaughan, ain't got the change of a nickel,
Ain't got no bounce in my shoe. You know how she does it. Ain't got no fancy to tickle. I ain't got nothing but the blues.
So it got to the point there. I thought, well, sounding like these women is probably not a good thing. Trying to imitate how somebody else's voice sounds.
Hurry, sun down, make it
soon. How are you going to sing somebody else's life?
Make way for the moon.
It's got to be your life that you sing about, your experience, your pain or joy, the particular way that makes you laugh, like your own laughter. You know, why are you going to imitate somebody else's laughter?
Make way for the moon.
Renee Marie's latest CD is Live at the Jazz Standard. Learn more at our website, here-now.org.
There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Arthur T. Gregorian in Newton, hosting Art on the Floor, an information session about Oriental rugs with Dick Gordon, tomorrow night from 7 to 9. Tickets at WBUR.org. ThoughtForms, recently named Custom Builder of the Year by Custom Home Magazine. Their work can be viewed at thoughtforms-corp.com. And Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term computer rental services for conferences, conventions, and special events, 617-261-6060. Now's your chance to make a pledge for the news that'll enter your name in a drawing to win a new Apple iBook laptop computer, courtesy of Tech Superpowers. Enter the drawing with your $100 pledge for the news online at WBUR.org. Coming up at 1 o'clock, Fresh Air with Terry Gross. She'll be talking with journalist and author Philip Hiltz, who writes about health and science policy.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now, and Bill and I have moved down the hall to the kitchen where we're joined by Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, and listeners in Philly, Baltimore, Jersey Shore, the Carolina area, down south.
They will be excited. They will be familiar with what we're doing today.
Right. Which is what?
Which is soft shell crabs, which is a truly seasonal food. We do not, you know, in this world where you can get strawberries in February and raspberries in January, this is a food that's only available for a short period of time. I had a very hard time finding them because the season is just beginning. I learned something really interesting, which is that these are blue crabs.
They're beautiful, by the way.
But touch this, because you'll learn immediately what's different.
Beauty's in the eye of the beholder, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the color, I mean, I know the poor things, we should say a little something over them.
They look a little like something that may have been smeared on the highway.
Oh.
To be honest.
Come on, we're going to try to build appetites
here. They are delicious.
Here.
They're slate blue. We've got a plate of the crabs here, and they're sort of a slate blue
with
color.
With this gorgeous kind of pale tones, and then an orange crab. It's a blue crab, but what happens this time of year is that the crabs molt, and they shed their shells. And the fishermen catch these before the hard shell reforms. So it is truly a delicacy that's only available for a short time because apparently these hard shells begin to form very quickly. So you want to get them. I wanted you to touch them because it's completely 100% soft.
It is right. Soft shell crab. You mentioned it's seasonal, and it's also regional. I mean, Baltimore,
that's where they're from. I mean, you don't find these in Texas unless they've been flown over. It is an Eastern Seaboard delicacy. What happens, this fascinates me, is that the myth, and I think it may be more than myth, is that blue crabs are very in touch with nature, and they are said to be influenced by the phases of the moon, which is just a bizarre, I mean, you know, we're all animals out here, right? So in their natural environment, they begin to shed these outgrown shells on the first full moon of May. And what happens is that they then become these prized delicacies called soft-shell crabs. What is fabulous about these is that the entire crab is edible. Now, if you go to the Maryland coast in Baltimore, you get those huge crabs. You eat them at tables, and you crack them with mallets, and they're on white paper tables. And you have to pick and work, just like you have to do with lobster in New England. It's a lot of work, and there's meat inside, but you're working. This, the whole crab, is edible. So as a cook, I really like to respect that. You see them frequently in restaurants with heavy sauces, and they've been, you know, flambéed and this and that. And I just want to taste this thing because the shell is so soft and edible, and the meat is so sweet.
Now, for how long are they served? Are they served for the
season? You mean?
Yeah.
The season begins right around now, just May 1st, and they in some places they're said to go as long as September. I've never seen them that late. I actually think of them as only having a 6 to 8 week season. So you really have to get them now. And that's, of course, like anything in our lives, if we don't have it all the time, we grow to love it even more.
But quick question before we start cooking it. So how do you get them? Do you order them and they come frozen? Or?
You know, I did have quite a search for them. I called around because it's very early in the season, but I really wanted to introduce listeners to it now so they can start looking for them. They are becoming available. You can ask at your fish shop. Go to a really high-quality fish shop. What you'll find is that they come in three different sizes. Jumbo is the largest, then large and medium. Most of the jumbo ones tend to go to the fancy restaurants. I'm just going to heat my pan
expensive?
Up here. Very expensive. Mm. And they will become less expensive as we get more into the season. Each one of these lovely beauties, as you put it, were almost $5.
Oh,
so it's nothing you just snack on. I mean, it's really for a special treat. And again, that's why you see them a lot deep fried in restaurants. Blech. I don't really understand what the need is for that. Why do you want to put a deep fry fatty thing on this gorgeous edible crab? So what we're going to do is I'm heating up
Americans,
a,
darn it.
Right, we love our fat.
It's this in the Constitution.
That's right. This is a very quick dish. Now, when I say quick, the whole thing happens in under 5 minutes, which is why we're having such a leisurely chat.
Mm,
I was wondering
How
about that.
How are you,
that.
Kathy?
I'm well.
Oh,
lovely
good.
Weather we're having. No, here we go. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take half a cup of cornmeal. Cornmeal is going to give us texture. It's going to give, we're going to coat the crab, and I'm going to also add a little bit of flour. So I've got about a half a cup of each. All we're going to do, this is called dredging. You do this with a lot of fish fillets. We're going to mix the cornmeal and the flour, about a half a cup of each, with some salt.
Just, would you do that cornmeal flour mix then, as you, I think you just said, on other fish or scallops?
Absolutely anything. You could do it on scallops. You could do it on fillet of sole. You could coat a bluefish with it. The reason that it's so nice with the crab is that the cornmeal does give it a nice texture and a little bit of flavor, and it adheres to it nicely. Mm. So we've got salt and pepper, and we've got cornmeal and flour. And we're going to, we're smoking here already. We're going to add just a touch of butter for flavor, and then you can use vegetable oil or olive oil. And what we want to do is get our pan extremely hot, and I think we're doing quite well in that category.
You added about, a few teaspoons there?
About a teaspoon of butter and maybe a little bit more of olive oil. You just want to lightly coat the pan, give it a good sizzle.
Why do you use the two?
It's because you get flavor from both of them, and it's a wonderful combination. But again, if you really were watching calories, you could just use vegetable oil.
Okay.
I'm taking the whole crab. These have been cleaned. And it's hot. What that means is that the fishmonger removed a flap that's on the other side of the crab and took some of the little guts out. Bill, you don't have to get
we'll leave it at that.
To it.
We'll leave it at that.
All right, we'll leave
Poor
it at
guy.
That.
The little crab's got his arms.
It is amazing, though, isn't it, Robin, that there's only a few minutes left in this segment, and we really haven't even started cooking yet.
But
and
here we go.
Kathy
watch.
Seems quite comfortable.
Kathy's very relaxed,
quite relaxed
today, yes. Okay, because also this is, everybody that's walked into this kitchen has said, oh, I love soft shell crabs. People are pretty passionate about it. I've dredged them, that's our term,
both
lightly
sides.
Coating them on both sides. Shaking it off to make sure that there's not a lot of flour adhering to it. And I've got four of them here, just enough for each of us to have our own here.
And it doesn't matter back or front, I see you.
No, because we're going to flip them very gently. We're going to cook them for less than 3 minutes on each side, again, over a very high heat here. And what's going to happen is that they're going to cook quickly and become golden brown. Now, in terms of a sauce or any other flavorings, I'm not going to do a lot because I really want to taste the crab. So I have some slivered almonds and some fresh lemon, and that's it. That's all I'm going to add because you just want to taste the freshness of this.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a real plate for you guys today. Are you impressed?
Yeah. The last time I cooked with Jean-Louis Paladin, the late, great chef, once, and he said a plate just like this down on the stove and forgot it was the lit burner, and it exploded.
It does
so
do that.
So this is not lit, right?
Now, listen, this is a wonderful sound for a radio. These things tend to pop And that means that they're getting a lot of heat and they're ready to be flipped. You want to use, that? Yeah, we want to use a spatula. Look at that beautiful golden brown color. We're flipping them over. About a minute on this side and we're done. If the pan starts to get dry, you can add a tiny bit more oil just so that they get that beautiful color on each side.
Well, that thing really spit when it popped.
Oh, I love the sound of soft shell crabs. There we've got the sizzle. And that's all we're going to do. We're going to take them out of the pan. Again, I have tongs or a spatula. Do not use a fork. You don't want to pierce. These crabs are very juicy. And we're going to add our almonds to the pan. And a squeeze of lemon juice.
It really is kind of cooking 101, isn't it?
Look at this.
Simple.
Bill, can you do this?
Yes, yeah. Even conceivable.
It's extremely easy, and I'm telling you, it is one of the most appreciated dishes of spring. Mm. A beautiful dish to serve with spring asparagus. And, I mean, who can't do this? I think these crabs are
We'll
give them the recipe. But
usual, if you have any problems, do write us because Kathy will help you.
Okay, that's it. They're finished. Would you guys like to try these?
Yeah. I'm cooking right up.
Here we have, I call this soft shell crab almondine. It's a very classic dish. Here's a squeeze of lemon for you, and we're going to sprinkle some almonds on top.
You want to go for it?
Sure.
I think the first thing that you'll notice is how exceptionally juicy they are.
And, of course, how easily they cut, considering
it's
a crab.
It's a crab, exactly. And that you're going to be eating the whole thing, and it's going to be warm. I will warn you of that. But I would serve this with a beautiful bottle of dry white wine and some spring asparagus. You barely need any bread with it. It's the essence of the season. Well, I don't think it gets much better than this.
I think Bill's going to confirm all of that. Also that his tongue just got scalded.
Uh-oh, he's got that look of yikes.
Affirmatively delicious.
Just, isn't that wonderful?
So succulent and juicy,
and then,
as you said.
The nuts, the almonds really highlight the crab flavor. So you can do it.
We
Go
can
home.
Do it. You
Look
can
for
do
those
it home. Here in House Resident Chef Kathy Gunst, as always, we thank her. And for her recipe for soft-shelled crab almondine. And
Correct.
If you get some pictures of the process, check out our website at here-now.org. Kathy, thank you so much. First sign of spring is not a robin, it's a crab.
It's
thank
Kathy.
It's Kathy cooking crabs.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Special thanks today to Sean Carberry for sharing his spam.
Yes, indeed. Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest news.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
WBUR funders include...